Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Debbie Guy-Geesh, author of From Backroom to Boardroom, Earn Your Seat with Strategic Marketing Operations. And you, my friend, are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a free copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Debbie Guy-Geesh to talk about her book, From Backroom to Boardroom, Earn Your Seat with Strategic Marketing Operations, published by Forbes Books. Debbie Guy-Geesh isn't here to sell you on a panacea marketing technology or convince you of the critical data you just aren't seeing. Rather, Debbie's passion is found in the work she does every day. Give marketing leaders the ideas, strategies, and confidence they need to reimagine the role of their marketing team and redefine its impact. As partner and chief strategy officer of the Pedowitz Group, Debbie has helped marketing teams drive revenue growth, foster customer centricity, and lead digital transformation. With a focus on revenue operations, the customer experience, and a personalized omni-channel marketing mix, Debbie has established herself as a thought leader and digital pioneer, spearheading the overdue shift of traditional marketing strategies to what she coined as revenue marketing in 2011. Since then, marketing operations became her area of expertise, devising strategy to execution plans that earn marketing a seat at the table. She is also the author of Rise of the Revenue Marketer, which was featured on episode 159 of the Marketing Book Podcast in 2018. And interesting fact, in 2019, she earned her doctorate. Dr. Guy-Geesh, congratulations on From Backroom to Boardroom, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here. And I just got chills. I'm like, who is that woman? I want to talk to her, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so excited to have you back. And you don't know this, Dr. Debbie, but you have been traveling with me for years because I have been giving presents.
Does your wife know?
No, no. What I mean by that, I give her presentations and I often have a picture of you and your book where I talk about the importance of revenue. And always comes up. And one thing I wanted to mention is that you are a graduate of Auburn University.
War damn eagle. Yes, I am.
Yes. And I read your book during this last week, but I did have to set it down to watch the Auburn-Alabama game.
Oh, I'm so sad about that.
Well,
it was a sad day.
Well, there's always next year. And you were at Auburn when the Apple CEO, Tim Cook, was there. Did you ever run into him at any fraternity parties or keggers?
I did not even know that. That is fascinating. Now I have to go look him up.
He is such an Auburn fan. Oh, gosh. It's even on his Twitter profile. It says Apple CEO, Auburn fan.
Oh, wow. I'm going to have to go look that up and see if we did run into each other at some point. Boy, did I miss that one, right?
Yeah. So as I was saying, I've taken you on these trips. And at one point, I was giving a talk to the American Marketing Association in Birmingham, Alabama. And your picture came up on the screen as I was making a point about your book. And since I was in Alabama, I said, she's an Auburn grad. And about half the room erupted in excitement and cheers, and the other half not happy.
That's what always happens. It's always a house divided in Alabama.
Right. So I said, well, now, wait a minute. I've interviewed an Alabama grad, Philip Stutz. And I've interviewed him twice now. And so I was able to keep the peace in that room when I was giving that talk to show, hey.
You always have to be careful and be ready for that fine line.
Yes, I'm a uniter, not a divider, you know.
That's right.
But the problem is I've interviewed him twice, and now I've been able to rebalance things and interview you twice so that we're back at equilibrium. And last weekend during the game, I was messaging him. And I said, hey, next week I'm interviewing an Auburn grad. And you know what his response was?
I can't imagine.
Not cool.
Or rude. Yeah. That would also be a good response.
So anyway, that's I'm just happy to, for a variety of reasons, to be able to speak to you, but also to, you know, try to get some peace back with all the listeners in Alabama.
As you said, you are a uniter, not a divider.
Yes, that's right. Now, were you born in Alabama?
No, Georgia.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay.
I went to Auburn. And this is a true story. I had a high school teacher take me over there. Her daughter had gone there. And in one day, I got advanced placement, I got funding, and I got housing in one day.
Wow.
It was meant to be.
My goodness. Okay. Well, because I was born in L.A.
Oh, Lower Alabama. Oh, yeah. You're so funny. I did not know that, Douglas. I didn't know you were born in Lower Alabama.
Yeah. Why Where? Do you think I'm so excited to speak to you? I was born at Fort Rucker, which is an Army post in southeastern Alabama. My dad was stationed there at the time, and then we moved back there when I was about 11 for 3 years. But
and
anyway,
you know, right now I live in Pensacola, Florida, and right now I'm looking across my bay, and I can see Florida's on the left. Alabama's on the right. I'm right here on the line.
Well, you know what's interesting is that you're in Florida, and Philip Stutz has also been banished to Florida.
What part of Florida is he in?
He's over in Santa Rosa Beach, over near Panama City Beach.
I know exactly where that is. It's 1 hour down the road from me.
Yeah, and my brothers and I own a house on the beach at Panama City Beach. So if I ever get back down there, you know, it may be time to have you over for some adult beverages.
Yeah, living in, growing up in Lower Alabama, you know Panama City Beach well, I imagine.
Right, and that's why my parents bought the house there 50 years ago.
Do they still have it?
Yeah, we still own it.
That's fantastic.
No, well, I mean, they lived at Fort Rucker.
Uh-huh.
And this Panama City Beach is only 2 hours away, and they bought this beach house like in 1973. And then our parents have passed away, but my brothers still own the house.
It's beautiful down here. It's absolutely beautiful down here. And we were talking beforehand. We have, because my house is right on the bay, which opens up to the Gulf. It's a huge bay. It's Perdido Bay. And we have bells all over our house so that, and you can see, it's just like you can't even see land where I'm sitting in my office right now. All you can see is water. And we have these bells in the house so that if we see a dolphin or a manatee, somebody rings the bell and we all run outside to take a look at them.
That is so great. And if one goes off during the interview, the listener is going to know.
Well, I did kibosh the bell ringing while we're doing the interview, but okay. Yes. But if I see one, I will let you know.
Okay, great. Well, so just so you listeners know that she's, you know, showing some restraint here. So your book, the foreword, is written by Scott Brinker.
It is.
Author of Hacking Marketing, which was featured on the Marketing Book Podcast, episode 63, back in 2016. And I want to read an excerpt from page one and then get into some definitions that I think would be helpful.
Sure.
As a professional marketer, aren't you tired of the backroom stigma and being treated as a second-class citizen? Do you believe you are ready and deserve to move up and claim an elevated voice and more strategic role? Then read on, because I wrote these pages for you. I put this book together because I wanted a tool that could provide inspiration to frustrated and underappreciated marketers. In the chapters that follow, you'll find a vision of what can be and a chance to reimagine, redefine, and reinvent the role of B2B marketing. In short, it is a key to a bigger and better future for marketing propelled by what I call strategic marketing operations. Okay, so Dr. Gagish, there are probably three groups of listeners right now. One group doesn't know what marketing operations is, and that's fine. One group probably does know what it is, and then there's another group that thinks they know what it is, but they may not be clear on it. So I am the king of asking really stupid questions because, like my fellow Alabama native Forrest Gump said,
I'm not a smart man.
Douglas.
So, Debbie, explain what marketing operations is as defined in your book.
Sure, absolutely. And that's a great question because, again, there are so many forces that are impacting sales, marketing, how we do all of that today. And people are coming from a lot of different places, and there is a lot to learn and there is a lot to know. So marketing operations is all about the care and feeding of the marketing technology systems that enable marketing to be all that they can be. And for those of you who aren't as aware of this space, marketing will spend $8.5 billion in 2023 on marketing technology. When I first got into the game, Douglas, I bought my first marketing automation system in 2004. There were maybe like four pieces of technology. There are now over 10,000. So we have these marketing organizations who are now being enabled to become true business and revenue contributors into the business, but only if they have that right MarTech stack and if it has the constant care and feeding and utilization that it needs. You've got to be doing the right things and you've got to be doing things well. So a marketing operations professional is all about, you know, we have a tech stack here, and is it as optimized as it can be? Is it as integrated with other systems as it needs to be? And is the technology giving us a return into the business? And that is the role of marketing operations.
There's a great quote on page 115 from Danny Esner.
Oh, I love Danny.
Vice President of Revenue Marketing for Sissons. And he says, the way I define marketing operations is probably narrower than others. I see it as managing the systems, data, and possibilities to make a scalable revenue machine as efficient as possible. So just to add to what you explained, why does the term button pusher really irritate marketing operations people?
This is a great story. And again, you talked about Scott Brinker writing the foreword, and Scott Brinker has been such a guiding light for me in marketing operations. And the whole idea for the book came from a presentation that I did at one of the MarTech conferences, and we were doing the West Coast conference. And I had a group of about maybe 200 marketing operations professionals in the room. And I made the comment that a lot of you in your company, you're probably perceived as button pushers. And honestly, Douglas, when I said that, you would have thought I had reached into their chest and ripped out their hearts. They had such a visceral reaction to that term. And then I went on to talk about how you could be so much more. You could provide so much more business value to the company. They're like, yes, yes, yes. And people would come up to me afterwards and we would talk about that. And it was that reaction. I'd already been thinking about writing a book, but it was that reaction and that event that made me think about how great would it be to lift up these people and this profession. And I do see marketing operations as the only way that today's B2B CMO will make a credible impact on growth and revenue. It is their secret sauce. And if you just have a bunch of button pushers who are being reactive versus people who have a vision for how technology can transform a business, how technology can help a company gain competitive advantage in a business, and this comes from a strategic marketing operations organization. So that's kind of how the book got written, and even today, marketing operations professionals still have such a negative reaction to that term. as they should.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's probably like the term I often use on the show. Marketing is sometimes perceived in certain companies as, you know, arts and crafts party planners who work in the make it pretty department. And that really irritates them, and it should, and it's not true, but that's like the perception that others who don't work in that area might have.
I think part of what's happened there, and there's been some research on this, executives think they know more about marketing than any other part of the business, right? Because they think, no, true. How hard can this be? And yet the role of marketing and what it can do to drive an organization's growth and future has changed so dynamically in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years. And these executives are not always prepared and knowledgeable the way that they need to be. I've often said that any CEO needs to be fired if they are not using marketing as a revenue engine in their organization. Now, that's not true for every company, but it is true for a majority of companies. Because what's the role of a CEO? The role of a CEO is to return shareholder value. And the way that you do that is to optimize the mix of resources that you've got. So if you have a marketing department that is spending hundreds of thousands, millions every year on marketing technology, and they are not in effect driving growth and revenue for your organization, then whose fault is that? It's the CEO's fault. So,
amen, sister. I'm with you on that. And that's why in the years ahead, and you even talk about this, as I recall, well, from backroom to boardroom, you're going to see more CEOs come from the marketing ranks because they understand, they will understand that is the biggest lever to grow revenues.
You know, it's so interesting, Douglas, that post-pandemic, if you take a look at the stats that have come out prior pandemic, executives knew that digital transformation was important. Post-pandemic, it is an absolute got to do it yesterday, got to do it now, and they're throwing money at that. And yet, if you take a look at a lot of companies, the earliest digital transformations that happened within those organizations was within the marketing organization, mm-hmm. because the whole world of MarTech and digital transformation for marketing has been going on for what, again, I bought my first marketing automation system in 2004. You know, we're looking at 18, 19, almost 20 years of that. So marketing in a lot of ways is a bit of a leader in what digital transformation is and how it can transform parts of the business.
TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flipped the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a free copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Let's talk about one part here. I know this is going to be frustrating for you as it is for all authors because there's only a few things I can pull out, but I think these are the things that just really got me fired up. The CMO's three biggest challenges. You write, the emergence of marketing operations as a strategic marketing capability is partially driven by three game-changing CMO obligations. And let me read those, and we'll talk about them. Drive credible revenue and growth, grow revenue. Define and execute the vision for digital transformation, go digital, which you were just mentioning, and lead and implement the pivot to customer centricity, engage customers. You write, driving revenue and growth is the result that matters the most for today's CMO. And you go on to write that it was kind of funny. You said that you acknowledged that the readers were kind of hoping that digital transformation was the top priority, but that it's actually growing revenue. What Why did you make that point? Is that because the growing the revenue is the most frightening part?
It is. It is. And this is really interesting because these three CMO challenges have been what I identified as the top three CMO challenges for a number of years now, even prior to writing this book. And think about it. You know, there's been a huge need for marketing to go digital, which is why they're looking at an $8.5 billion spend by 2023, right? So we were already there. In a lot of ways, marketing was happier when they could just, oh, it's all about the technology. Well, it isn't. It's about what that technology can do, and that is growing revenue. And I remember back in the early days, because we started the company in 2007, and I would go around and do all these talks, and I would ask how many people in the audience have any kind of revenue accountability. I might get one hand, right? This is back in 2010, 2009. And now just about every single hand will go up in a room. So the companies understand that marketing should and could be accountable for helping to drive revenue. A majority of CMOs are now being compensated based on their impact on the business. And so it is the center of the universe, and it is very difficult for marketing to get their heads around that. I was talking to somebody the other day, Douglas, and we were talking about we could take out PowerPoint decks from like 5, 6, 7 years ago, changed the year, and we could still be giving that same message about the importance of growing revenue. And I have found that there is an appalling lack of understanding across marketing organizations around what the world of sales is about. So often we go into companies, and one of the reasons why marketing has a problem growing revenue, even though they're drowning in technology that enables them to do so, is because they do not understand sales. And so those CMOs, those VPs of marketing, those teams that can work closely with the sales team, create one revenue team, those are the ones that are going to win. And what's been interesting about go digital, grow revenue, and engage customers is over time, what people are focusing on has changed. So, for example, it was go digital first, and then it was the revenue, and revenue continues. But this engage customers, again, Douglas, especially post-pandemic, is of paramount importance. And the way it goes is like this. You've got to have the digital chops to engage customers where they are and how they want to be engaged so that you can drive the most revenue. So that's how it works. And so these are challenges. Again, you know, CMOs have lots of challenges, but these are three top-level challenges that if a CMO is going to keep their job, this is what they'll need to focus on.
Mm. Let me just read what I thought was such a powerful section from page 32, where you said, you know, I'm sure you were wishing that you were hoping digital transformation was first, but it's revenue. And you write, trust me, it is driving revenue and growth. Here's why. If marketing can't do this right, they will forever be a second-class citizen. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter how cool of a MarTech stack you have accumulated. If what you do doesn't help enable and drive credible revenue growth, get ready for a job change right along with your CMO. I am unclear on how you can do your job as a CMO if you do not have financial accountability. Thinking more about it, if you do not have financial accountability as a CMO, I do not think that you will be a CMO for a long time in the organization. The constant and growing pressure for revenue results gives many B2B CMOs sleepless nights and anxiety-filled days. In fact, over 80% of CMOs state they feel enormous pressure to show financial results. Only a third, however, report items such as revenue and ROI, yet marketing is drowning in revenue-enabling technology and data. Both are essential elements to revenue accountability.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
So, Douglas, I should have hired you to be my book reader. Oh my gosh, that was so great. And clearly it's something that I'm very, very passionate about. You know, current stats show that B2B CMOs have a shelf life that is 50% less time than every other executive on the team. And that number has been growing, and the shelf life for today's B2B CMO has actually gotten the narrowest been in quite some time. And most cases, it's because they can't connect to revenue. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. Whenever you work on a doctorate, you have to write a dissertation. And about 50% of people who begin a doctorate don't complete it because the dissertation is very difficult to write, or at least it was for me. And whenever you write a dissertation, you have to have a problem in the literature. And my problem was the gap between you have all this technology that enables CMOs to create a revenue result. And at the time, we still had a lot of pressure on them, and only about 30% were showing that they were able to show that return on investment. And I was so afraid in the 2 years that it took for me to write my dissertation that that gap was going to close. It hasn't closed at all.
It never will.
Douglas.
Yeah.
It hasn't closed. And there are lots of reasons for that. I think a lot of those have to do with legacy thinking, legacy structures, legacy business models. But also, I can't stress enough the role of a strategic marketing operations organization that really becomes the secret sauce for the CMO. I often talk about the head of marketing ops as the CMO's wing person, right? Mm-hmm. So that when the CMO goes into that board meeting, they have the data that shows how they are driving revenue. And so again, it is, and we will begin to see this, CMOs, I was working with a company earlier this year, one CMO out, another CMO in. The first CMO couldn't spell revenue if he tried. The second CMO was brought in specifically to help drive revenue in that organization. So this growing revenue will continue to be at the forefront of what marketing is responsible for. You said earlier, marketing is no longer the make it pretty department. They are, how can we drive business? How can we drive growth? How can we drive revenue? How can we create competitive advantage in our organizations?
Mm. Digital transformation is a term that perhaps, like marketing operations, may be misunderstood. So can you explain what you mean by digital transformation?
It's so simple. Don't overcomplicate this. It's taking something that used to be manual and automating it.
Mm.
That's what digital transformation is. You know, I used to do spreadsheets, and now things are done automatically for me in a program. In the world of MarTech, and that's all the technology that's associated with marketing, this automation is on steroids that are on steroids. So think about it this way. One of the great things about having a MarTech stack is what I call digital body language. And that means that you have technology that sees what people are doing on your online properties. And based on that online behavior, it automated responses are set up. So it's like you're having a dialogue, and in the world of digital, you are creating a dialogue, a conversation, and a relationship that adds value to what that person is doing in that online property. So it's automation on steroids.
Mm. Let me back up and ask you, because we talked about marketers not understanding sales like they should, and that is one of my soapboxes from which I shout. And it's just
hallelujah, why, brother.
I've had over 50 books on the show about sales specifically. And if anyone would like a document that has a link to every one of those sales book interviews, just message me on LinkedIn and I'll send it to you. But in the book, you talk about how folks are, they're just not thinking, what is it that is keeping marketing from understanding more about sales? Because I feel like I'm doing my part, and my heart aches when I keep hearing about these marketers who just seem like they're really out of touch and don't know the first thing about what the sales folks are trying to accomplish.
Well, first of all, it's poor leadership. Because if you have a marketing leader at any stage of leadership and they don't understand the importance of understanding what's going on over in sales, and if they are not creating processes to connect with that, I mean, that is clearly a failure of leadership. Marketers come into work every day, and there's always plenty of work to do. But putting that work into the right context is what matters. And I remember in my first book, Rise of the Revenue Marketer, I actually put together what I called a marketing and sales synergy model. And I still use that today. I recently had an engagement with a customer, Douglas, and our whole goal in the project was to create a combined playbook for lead generation. And I will tell you, in all the years that I have been working in this, I have never worked with a head of sales that was so excited about working with marketing. And it was such a pleasure.
Isn't that great?
It was night and day.
Yes.
And whenever we work with marketing today, you know, we have certain lines in the sand that we have to draw with them, to where if they're not involving sales, we just can't do the work for them. Because you have to have, I call it one revenue team. And that's what we're seeing in the best companies. Marketing is not doing part of it, and sales is they're doing it together, mm-hmm. right? And it becomes one team. Because if you think about that customer journey is what, 60, 70, 80% digital. And who owns the digital relationship? It would be marketing, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And because customers are always going to be online, no matter if they're whatever stage of the journey, their customer journey that they're in, marketing is looking at that digital body language and can respond to it in a way that makes sense. And so if I go into an organization and marketing cannot tell me what sales is all about, and there are certain kinds of work that they want us to do, like lead management or get more leads or those kinds of things, I'm like, we need a timeout, because if we don't involve sales in this, I don't want to just take your money. I want to take your money and help you be wildly successful.
Yeah.
And it's the craziest thing I have ever seen. And you've been in this market a long time too, Douglas, and you see that. And I actually I've actually outlined a book, and it's probably going to turn into an ebook, and it will be a series of courses for marketers to understand what they need to know about sales.
Oh,
how they can
I love
put
it.
Themselves into the sales shoes and see what their world is like. I mean, I see misses, like I was working with a company, large company, a very well-known company, and the CMO was like, we give them all these leads and they don't follow up. So I said, okay, let me go to the VP of sales and see what's going on here. And the VP of sales informs me, you know, marketing's working on net new. We don't have a charter to go get net new. We just have a charter to drive revenue. And my reps make as much money on a renewal as they do on a net new piece of business. So tell me where my reps are going to spend their time.
Yeah.
I mean, how simple is something like that, right?
Oh, well, please let me help promote that, because that is one of my great interests is in trying to help the marketing folks understand more about sales. And frankly, the most successful marketers are the ones that have a deep understanding of sales. And I should add that you're ambidextrous. You've got this marketing background, but you were also like a vice president of sales. You were director.
For many years.
Yeah.
Yeah, for many years. And so I have that sales background. And I remember I was the CMO of a tech company in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was the only time I had ever been just head of marketing. My prior career to that, I was in sales, running sales, and had marketing as a tour of duty a time or two, right? Mm. And I remember my
like a combat tour.
Like a combat tour, yeah. So my CEO came into my office one day, and this is in 2004, and he says, Debbie, what are we going to do about revenue? And I started laughing, and I said, Rusty, you know, it says VP of marketing on the door out there, not sales. He says, yes, but I need for you to help me figure this out, because you have a background in sales. And that really was my whole journey into revenue marketing and into this world. Okay, there goes a dolphin right there right in front of my dog.
Oh.
He was a big one. He was beautiful. So
he's showing off because he knew
he's
that you
showing
were
off. He's
on
showing
this interview.
Off. He's
yeah.
showing off. And so that began my journey toward revenue marketing. And because I have that background, you know, from day one in buying the technology, it was always about how can we grow the business. That's what it was always about for me. And I find that marketers who have more traditional backgrounds, which we're seeing less and less of that, quite frankly, we're seeing more and more of people who are more aware of sales and not just this classical, traditional type of marketing backgrounds. And, you know, and I think that works and that's really good. But Douglas, it definitely helps to have a background in sales, no question about it.
And I seem to recall, this might have happened, you know, the memory goes first, Debbie, but when I was interviewing you about Rise of the Revenue Marketer, I think you told me about an organization where if you're going to work in marketing, you had to work in sales for a quarter.
Absolutely, and we've seen this. I have a couple of VPs and friends who, when they hire marketers, they have them do a tour of duty, typically on the SDR team, mm-hmm. so they can listen into calls, understand what a day in the life is about, and those people are much more prepared. And I've even put metrics in place for marketers: time in front of customer, time on sales calls. And those are things that the marketing team had to have. It was like an annual renewal. I've got to have so much time in front of talking to real customers, and I have to have so much time on sales calls listening. And it actually became a KPI for the marketing team.
Mm, that is great. Well, let me just ask you one question about the customer centricity, and then we'll go into the marketing operations maturity model before we wrap up. But so we talked about the revenue growth and the digital transformation. Customer centricity, it's not proclaiming that you love your customers. It's more of a structural concept. Explain what you mean by customer centricity.
Whenever I was writing my dissertation, I probably had about 14 or 15 different theories that I was working on. And one that absolutely struck me was this theory called market orientation. And what market orientation means is it's a company-wide capability to sense and respond to the customer in almost real time.
Mm.
Imagine if your company could do that.
Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a moment. You would have the wildest competitive advantage. It's like Amazon. Like when Amazon knows a big snowstorm's coming up in Maine and you haven't bought a snow shovel from them in 10 years, they'll send you a note. Hey, we got these snow shovels on sale and there just happens to be a snowstorm coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Today, especially post-pandemic, because what happened during the pandemic is everything went so virtual and people live on their devices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we know post-pandemic, people are a lot more comfortable with digital relationships, digital interactions, digital buying. And so post-pandemic, it's all about how can you make every digital experience your prospect or your customer has with you the best digital experience, because people are looking for experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking the B2C model and applying it to our B2B world. And this has become so heightened that if a revenue marketer is going to be successful, the marketing operations team has to use the power of that technology to digitally engage with these customers in the right way, no matter where they are in their customer journey, create incredible online experiences for them, and that is what drives revenue. So digital transformation was where it was a few years ago. Revenue came into fore. Post-pandemic, this customer engagement and companies being more customer-centric versus product-centric is where the world is today. And you know this, Douglas, so many marketing operations organizations or marketing teams that we work with, the organizations are still product-centric. Nobody gives a hoot about the product. They care about what it's going to do for them. And this is heightened to unparalleled levels post the pandemic. So the marketing operations team, this is where they take that technology and they take all that investment in technology to create the best online experience to understand and know that customer, right, through those digital interactions that they have, so that they can create the best experience that drives revenue and that also drives longevity. So that's why it's important.
Yes. Now, Debbie, I loved your book. I loved your other book. It's great being able to talk to you. I'm such a fan, but I got to tell you something. You really warmed the cockles of this Southerner's heart when on page 68, you wrote, "Bless your heart."
I wanted to see how many people would find that. It was an intentional part that I put into the book.
Well, you're right. Bless your heart is a deeply Southern saying that is a precursor to soften and insult. And I tell you what, if you really want to irritate a Southerner, you say, oh, bless your heart. That is the most condescending. Oh, it just really,
it
grinds
really
my gears, as they say in the Northeast. But I found this bit where Ellen DeGeneres, who is from New Orleans, and I think another actor named Patrick Wilson were talking to James Corden, the British television show host, and they're talking about this. I just wanted to play this quickly.
I met someone from the South, and she came up, she spoke to me, and then she said, I was trying to park in a space, and I couldn't get in. She went, oh, darling, bless your heart.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's the nicest expression, you could ever have, to walk around.
It's not.
It's an insult.
Yeah.
Oh, really? What was she saying?
Well, like you poor, stupid person.
Oh!
Like, bless your heart is like, oh, you know, like that.
Oh, it gets, it gets you out of anything. Like, you could say, she's a horrible person, bless her heart.
Yeah.
Oh, I took it as like, oh, my God, she wants to bless my heart. This is beautiful.
No, she does not.
I was doing something very stupid at the time, so it does make sense.
So, Debbie, I just want you to know I appreciated that. And I just thought, man, she gets me. But I want to talk about the marketing operations maturity model, the MOM model.
The MOM model, yeah.
Yeah. And let me just say, it's five sections: unaware, and then efficient, effective, and then get revenue, and then customer centric, and then next generation. And those last three are the real strategic parts. And, you know, the more strategic, the more money that marketing operations, the more money that marketing operations professional is going to make. And you talk about how they're in such demand. But let's start with the unaware part. And
the bless your heart stage?
Yes. Why do you call that the bless your heart stage? What, tell us about
this
that.
This is a true story. I was having lunch one day with a CMO of a very large organization. And I said, well, what about marketing operations? And he looked at me and he said, I've heard of that. And all I could think in my mind was, bless your heart. Because, again, if a CMO does not understand the power of marketing operations and how it can be applied to deliver on the promise of marketing as a revenue and growth driver, then it is a bless your heart. Now, today, we're sitting looking at 2023. There were much fewer CMOs who I would think would fall into that category. However, they still do somewhat, but not like they used to, not when I first wrote this.
Mm-hmm. And when I read that story, that's why I really wanted to hammer home the definitions here, because I think that some people may be in that situation. There are some big-time CMOs listening to this who, you know, are probably going to go into the office next week, and the CEO is going to say, hey, talk to me about marketing operations. And they need to be prepared for that. So then the next one is the efficient effective, okay? And so I guess you didn't spend as much time talking about the unaware part, but it was a way of sort of saying, you know, if you're not on board yet, I understand, and here's what you need to do. And then most of the book goes into the real specifics about the types of things you need to do. And I want to quote from the next part on efficient effective. You write, let's see, this is page 110. The efficient effective stage can be pictured as a bit of a frenzy to get all the gears in place. And while there are many benefits that come during this stage, the best part may lie in what's ahead, because once those gears are in place, they can start turning and strategic motions can begin. So talk about this efficient, effective stage, and I guess how it actually helps with the digital transformation.
It's the foundation, right? You can't have an impact on the business if you don't have this foundation well in place. The problem with efficient and effective is I think that marketers continue to wallow at that stage.
A good word. They're almost unaware still.
Yeah, they're so inured with the technology and they're chasing the bright, shiny toy, and it's about the technology and how cool it is versus what do I need to do with this technology to drive a business result, right?
Yeah.
So efficient is doing things well. Do you have the right systems? Are they being optimized? Are they integrated? And effective really is about, are we doing the right things? Are we thinking about this in the right way? And so I think a lot of organizations are heavily into the efficient, effective stage. Mm-hmm. With some sprinkles of get revenue and customer centric. But this efficient and effective stage has got to be super tight. I just wrote an article for Spiceworks that publishes next week, and I did some predictions for marketing operations in 2023. And one of them is there's going to be some settling. There's going to be some sharpening. There's going to be some, let's get this tech stack right instead of it, you know, springing up like mushrooms after a spring rain and having pieces of technology everywhere. And that's going to be great for marketing operations becoming strategic, because you really do need to have that foundation in place. And so that's what we talk about when we say efficient and effective in this model.
Right. And you were starting to touch on what I think is the wrong way to buy MarTech, which you outline in this chapter about the shiny object, this enamored with...
You know, yeah. I told you that when I bought my first marketing automation system, there were like, I don't know, four pieces of technology. It was like 2004. It was a long time ago.
Was it Eloqua that you bought?
It was Eloqua. And I was customer number 12. I didn't know that until this year. I never knew that.
I'm sure they didn't want to tell you that when you were buying it.
They did not. They certainly, you know, did not want to tell me that. And yet, you know, today there are so many different pieces of technology. And we walk into organizations and they're just not using what they have. They're like, yeah, this would be really good, but we're just not at a stage where we can actually use it. It sounds good. We bought it, but we don't have the capability. We are not mature enough to use that technology. So I think there's going to be, and there has been post-pandemic, some rapid maturation, which is causing that efficient, effective stage to become tighter and to become more focused and pointed on customer centricity and getting revenue. And I think it portends for a great year in 2023 for the marketing operations team.
That's great. That's great. And there's so many good stories in here about things you've encountered and trying to help people understand all their MarTech. Yeah. And there was even there was one story where somebody came to you and said, look, these are all the 30 or 20 things we have. What should I keep? What should I get rid of? And you basically said, I don't know. But you actually came back and said it needs to be focused around how it helps your customer. But you said
this is a true story. I took that piece of paper and I turned it over and I drew a customer in the middle and I said, take a look at your customer, what they need, and then you want to align that technology around that customer.
Yes. Yes.
And I will say, I interviewed 26 executives for this book. So it's not just me spouting off. There are lots of insights from large companies, small companies, but 26 executives, and they had some keen insights to share.
Yes. And you talked about how when you look at this MarTech stack, or you do like a catalog of it, it different people bought it at different times for different reasons, and it's just sort of a hot mess. And when you, in a different part in the book, you had my favorite quote from the entire book, which is page 182, focusing on the customer is the way to accelerate the path to revenue.
Can you dig it?
So, Dr. Gagish, I do have to ask you a medical question.
Yes.
I've got this rash. No, I'm kidding. What is MarTech fatigue syndrome, and what are the symptoms?
That's a great question. MarTech fatigue syndrome is all about staying in that efficient and effective stage too long and chasing one bright and shiny toy after another and not getting any kind of business result. If you take a look at the sheer number of technology that's available to heads of marketing operations and CMOs to buy these days, what do you buy? How do you put it in? It's just a tsunami of technology. And, you know, 5 years ago, it was kind of exciting, but now you can't even possibly keep up. A lot of heads of marketing operations know the key categories of MarTech they need to invest in. And then from there, they'll know the top one or two systems that are there. But MarTech fatigue syndrome is exactly that, a tsunami, and how do you choose? And it's also getting very, what is the word I want to use, piece part. And I think that's going to continue. I think the best way to put together a MarTech stack will be by integrating pieces of your tech stack from different vendors. But MarTech fatigue syndrome is a real thing.
And you actually include in the book how to deal with it. Some of the skills you need and some of the practices. It's a very helpful prescription, Doctor. So let's go to the get revenue part, which is the third. And I want to quote from page 113. And we've talked a little about this, but I just can't resist. You write, "If you know nothing about me, know this. I began as a revenue marketer in 2004 and have not stopped since. A revenue marketer is a marketer or a marketing organization that is proactively responsible for driving revenue by building a digital foundation and accelerating customer centricity. A majority of my work, my business, and my academic research revolves around revenue marketing." Here's why I'm sharing this with you. It's my belief that you must understand and focus on what it takes to help marketing drive revenue and growth, creating a repeatable, predictable, and scalable revenue machine, being revenue marketers, is the only result that ensures marketing a voice and a seat at the table. Yet nothing continues to plague today's CMOs as much as achieving credible revenue results. So the people listening, a lot of marketers may want to do that. Is there anything else that's standing in their way? Are they waiting to be told to do this, or are they getting a lot of pushback from their organizations?
It has changed a lot in the years, I will say that. We are finding many more organizations at the CSO, CRO level, at the board level, understand the impact that revenue marketing can make on an organization. Again, Douglas, it comes back to leadership. And mm-hmm. I go to the story of the company where they had a CMO, and that CMO was not accountable for revenue. He just didn't get it. He was very much a branding, more traditional side, which is what the company hired. But they were at a point where they needed a CMO that could help drive revenue, top of funnel, leads. And so they now have a new CMO. And so we are seeing that begin to change. But this is all about leadership. This mm-hmm. is not about what people do day in and day out on their jobs.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch of friends who are VPs and CMOs, and I call them serial revenue marketers. I have a good friend of mine that just took a new job as a CMO. Well, guess what? The first thing that she needs to do is to get a revenue marketing mindset going on in that team. So we've done a whole series of what we call revenue marketing masterclasses, which are designed to help people begin to think differently about the possibilities and the power of marketing in their organizations. And that was one of the first things that she did. And the second thing that she did was she brought in a powerhouse marketing operations leader. Those were the first two things that she did, because she knew that she was hired to be a revenue marketing CMO, and she acquired a team that wouldn't know revenue if it slapped them across the face, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So she has to begin to change that attitude, change that culture within marketing to do that. So we are seeing some great CMOs, serial CMOs. These people are highly valued, highly sought after in the market. So it's very different than it was even 5 years ago, but it's still a very long way to go, as you know.
Yeah. I remember when I interviewed you a few years ago, you mentioned to me that you thought, you know, maybe you wrote the book in 2013. I think you said that you figured maybe a couple years, I'm not going to have to keep explaining this to people. And you said, I think I'm going to be explaining this for the rest of my days.
Yeah, I was telling my business partner the other day, it's the reason we're still a company, right? Because there's still so many organizations that need help. Again, every organization that we touch, they're drowning in this enabling technology. Why can't they get there?
Mm.
What's going on that they can't get there?
Well, let's talk about something real practical. I want to quote from page 118. You say a revenue marketing pioneer you greatly admire is Brian Vass.
Oh, yes.
Vice President of Sales Operations at Paycor. Mm-hmm. In a recent conversation I had with Brian, he succinctly laid out the familiar sales and marketing dilemma the firm faced in the past. He said, marketing throws leads over the wall to sales, and then marketing complains that the salespeople don't follow up with the leads. He said, we've all heard this tale. And salespeople say, marketing doesn't understand what we need. These leads are worthless. And marketing responds, why aren't you following up with my amazing quality leads? What is it that Paycor did to get around this problem?
They reorganized. You know the old axiom, structure follows strategy. So if you have a strategy that says that marketing is an important cog in that revenue machine, but the structure still has marketing, sales, customer service, all your customer-facing elements of the organization siloed into their own individual fiefdoms, mm-hmm. It is difficult to achieve that. So they created, and Brian gives a lot of credit to his VP for this, a RevOps organization. And Brian is one of the earliest RevOps professionals that I've met. And RevOps, which is that next generation on my model, RevOps is when you take your marketing operations, your sales operations, and your customer success or customer service operations, and you put them under one, they become one organization reporting either to the CRO or to the COO. And when you do that, magic happens. Mm-hmm. You now can set up across those three organizations one customer journey, one set of data, one set of optimal ways that we interact with the customer, consistent messaging. It is, I've seen it so magical in organizations, and Brian does an incredible job with that at Paycor. Now, it's only the smaller organizations that are doing this right now, as you would expect, Douglas, because at the end of the day, you know, if I'm CMO of a huge company, you know, these companies, it's all about political power.
Inertia. Yeah.
Inertia. And I call it legacy thinking, legacy structures, right?
Yep.
But I always ask people, I say, okay, well, if you could create your organization from scratch today, how would you do it? And you would do it from a RevOps organization. Mm-hmm. Because the reason it's important is because is that you can put the power of operations and technology across one view of the customer, one customer journey. The company speaks with one voice in every interaction that they have with the customer. That's the power of RevOps.
Structure follows strategy. Love it. It's so true. And I, you know, it makes me think of so many companies that think strategy will follow the structure. No,
it doesn't work that way.
But that's the impulse that so many companies seem to have, at least the ones that I've dealt with in the past.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. So let's go to the customer-centric part. And I almost can't believe this, but I want to read it and then maybe have a lover's quarrel here. You're right. For decades, companies took a product-centric focus. Marketing flooded prospects with product slicks, product messaging, and product conversations. Today, companies are fleeing from this approach. Instead, they're shifting to a business model that centers on the customer. Maybe the companies you deal with, but it just seems to me that there still are not enough companies that are doing that.
There really isn't. And this love of a company that is customer-centric has been something that I've been passionate about for a long time. In the 70s, there was a lot of research that was done. This was primary research done both in business and also in academia from 70s to the 90s on the value of a customer relationship. And there was a great book written called The Discipline of Market Leaders. And it talked about three ways that you could gain competitive advantage in the market. One was price. Well, that can be copied eventually. One was
that won't last long.
Yeah, it doesn't last long. One could be product. Well, product can also be copied, you know, at some point. But the third way was on the strength of a customer relationship, which cannot be copied. And there have been so many studies over the years that show, that demonstrate, that prove companies that have a customer focus first orientation versus those that have a product first orientation will win in the market. And that is so true today. So many things have changed post-pandemic. Again, we live in a more digital world than ever before. Think about it. Who would have bought a car online, Carvana, 15 years ago, 10 years ago? It would be ludicrous that we would even think about doing something like that. Mm-hmm. So in this ever-increasing, you know, digital world, it is all about that customer experience. And that is how customers will win. I mean, that's how companies are going to win. So it's extremely important.
Let me ask just one other question about this customer-centric section. And I want to quote from page 152, where you write, "If you thought your job was hard before, getting marketing and other groups to move away from their siloed customer view and adopt a holistic customer view is an almost Herculean task. Yet the company cannot pivot to customer centricity without this change. To make it a bit easier, let's consider the long-held sacred view of marketing, the funnel. The marketing funnel has become the standard of measurement, performance, and contribution for marketers. Whether you depict a vertical or a horizontal funnel, the marketing funnel has become the mantra of marketers today. I will say it was good for its time." It's almost like we're getting ready to hear a bless their heart. But what? Why do we need to start to separate ourselves from this funnel, and what do we need to go to?
Your framework, your worldview determines how you show up to work every day. And as a marketer, if you show up every day with the idea of this funnel, inquiries, marketing qualified leads, sales accepted leads, SQLs, and close, then that's how you operate. We would rather take a look at a full customer journey and think about it from the customer's perspective, not because, again, I'm thinking about my job. I'm thinking about what I have to do when I have a funnel-centric view. If I take the idea, and we represent it as a loop, and so think about a loop.
Like an infinity loop.
Like an infinity loop. That's mm-hmm. exactly right. And these are all the stages of the customer's journey, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the things that you have to do. It's what the customer is experiencing. And if everybody were to take that view instead of, here's my little part that I've got to operationalize, then we would have that one view of the customer. Something that's happened in the past few years, which is just mind-boggling to me, is I see so many demand generation teams that are much more focused on net new business. And I understand.
Right, like the story you told earlier.
Because it's so difficult to get net new business. Mm-hmm. However, in the world of digital that we live in, you know, for example, I was working with a life sciences company, this whole very expensive scientific instruments, and then they sold the disposables that went along with that instrument. Well, we actually put together a program, a nurturing program, where once we saw that the number of disposables that they were buying deviated in a downward cycle from what their typical buying spend was, we would put them into a nurture and or an immediate phone call to the salesperson. Because when the number of disposable units bought dropped, that meant they were probably looking at another investment in a different instrument that was probably not this company's, and they would lose all of that business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you would only know that if you were looking at what the customer was doing.
Yeah.
You know, were they adopting it? Were they getting the value from it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there are so many opportunities for marketers if you get away from that damn funnel, excuse the language, and start taking a look at the customer journey, understanding digitally where they're connecting with you, and then taking the power of this digital technology to understand, to get customer insights, to share that information in almost real time with sales, with executives, or put them into a different kind of nurture campaign. I was doing a workshop one time with an organization on the West Coast, and when I started talking about this, we had three different business units in this huge workshop, and he said, oh my gosh, you can do that? Wait a minute, let me go get my renewals department, and all of a sudden renewals are in here, right?
Yeah.
So that's the story of how that works.
Mm. You know, it reminds me also of some books that have been on the show over the years about explaining. Start with trying to sell more to your current customers. They want to buy from you, and they need to.
Huge trend this year. That's a huge trend going into 2022. 2023 is focusing on current customers.
Oh, thank goodness.
Huge trend.
That's
and
great
again,
to hear.
I think a lot of times, depending on the kind of organization you have, marketing has been like shut off from that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas if I were coming in to do demand generation for an organization today, the very first thing that I like to do is I like to take a look at where all the opportunities are, where marketing can apply this cool technology that they've got. That could be on the net new side, or that could be working on the existing business side. It could be in either way. Think about it, especially, for example, if you're a company and you're selling a piece of technology and maybe you have a pilot period or a test period or a free period or something like that, you can take a look at how much it's being used, who's using it, how they're using it, and then you can determine what do they need next. Right?
Mm-hmm.
These are things that you can absolutely do with the technology. But as long as marketing comes into work every day and all they have in front of them is that funnel, that is all they're going to think about versus thinking about where and how can we apply all this cool technology that we have across that entire customer journey.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, finally, the last one is next generation. I just want to quote from page 74, you write, the next generation stage is about breaking down silos to drive an even better result. The hallmark of this stage is radical structural organization. Can you say more about this next generation stage? And is that probably the smallest number of companies that...
It is the smallest number of companies, and it's back to the RevOps organization that we had a little bit earlier. This is where companies take marketing ops, sales ops, customer success ops, and they create one organization from that. That is the radical reorganization.
Ah.
And again, we're seeing it primarily in smaller companies who have more agility, and they have less politics and fiefdoms,
yes,
and those kinds of things.
And the wolf is a little closer to the door.
Exactly right. And the wolf is a little bit closer to the door. But that's the way it's always been. It's been the more agile companies, especially in the digital world, that are eating the larger companies, you know, for breakfast.
Mm.
And so it is a radical reorganization. And one of the things that we're beginning to see and that we're helping companies with is we know that if you're a certain size organization, that type of radical reorganization is going to be difficult. Yet, this casual collaboration that I talk about is not working. So the next step after casual collaboration across those three organizations would be to create a center of excellence. And yes, it is still pieces and parts, but if you create a center of excellence, you have more structure to it, you have more commitment to it, you have people dedicated to it. So that's an interim step that we're seeing before companies move into that radical reorganization. They're building these collaborative COEs that help them get to the next level across marketing ops, sales ops, and customer success ops.
Let me ask just two other things. One is, Dr. Gagish, you teach an MBA class at the College of William & Mary in Virginia.
I do.
And just so you know, that's in my backyard. So the next time you're up here, if I find out you're here...
It'll be next September. I will let you know.
Oh, sure. Excellent. Excellent. And there was a very interesting story. You were teaching one section on marketing operations, and your friend Dan Brown, the vice president of marketing operations at Verint, was with you. And you talk about how he, you know, gave a great talk. And then one of the students in the back said, "Wow, I didn't know this type of organization existed. It sounds exciting. How do I get a job in this field?" Dan looked the class over, smiled, and responded, "I wouldn't hire any of you."
True story. You could have heard a pin drop.
Well, why did he say that? And what can people do to be hired by a guy like Dan Brown?
First of all, because it's true. He would not hire any of them. Having an MBA in no way qualifies you to become part of a marketing operations team. Most marketing operations professionals fall into their job by accident. You can interview all these marketing operations people and they'll tell you, "I didn't grow up saying I wanted to be a marketing operations professional," because it is still so new, especially in the B2B world. It is still so new. And there is this huge gap in talent for marketing operations professionals. And I have an entire chapter in the book where I talk about this talent challenge that is going on right now.
Purple unicorns.
Purple unicorns, that's exactly what I call them. You have to understand technology, data, analytics. You have to understand marketing, and you have to have a business sense about you, because your job is to come into work every day and drive a business result, right? That is a lot to have within a person and or to have within a single organization. So you can imagine that there is a huge gap in talent. I just saw a recent marketing operations survey. I think this is the one that was from this is the one that was actually from my friend at Highway Education, and they were talking about the skills gap, and nobody's filling that skills gap. Highway Education has a program, which is 14-week full-time program, but it's pretty much by invitation only. And then MO Pros is also trying to set up some type of curriculum for the marketing operations professional. And there's not a company out there that I know of that has any kind of specific training platform. They'll train you on how to run a piece of technology. Mm-hmm. But around everything that you need as a marketing operations professional, we just don't have it. That is changing. And in 2023, we'll see a lot more training around holistically what you need to be as a marketing operations professional. And it's also not taught in most colleges as well, which is why every year, and I've done that program for 13 years at the College of William & Mary, and every year we just blow their brains apart around how technology, especially in the B2B world, has changed and what it's all about and what it does. I think that this talent issue is a huge mitigating factor. It's a barrier. And the companies that can do the best job in getting the best talent will have a competitive advantage in the next few years for sure.
Mm. And just so the listener knows, this is a big section of the book about the skills that are needed, how to source that kind of skill. There's a lot of options, pros and cons for all of them. Mm-hmm. And even training, and you talk about the playbook that you all have. I think it's an 18-month training program at your company. Mm-hmm. But the last question I wanted to ask about was from page 208, because this surprised me a little bit. You write that this is about training skills with marketing operations leaders. "I find among them little patience for training and even less rigor. I have found this to be true across all parts of marketing." Can you explain what you're seeing there? And I was surprised by that.
So how many sales books have you interviewed?
Over 50.
Do they have sales training in their organizations?
Well, a lot of these people are sales trainers. They own companies.
Right, they're sales trainers. So what I'm saying is, in the world of sales, training is accepted. Training is done. Every aspect of training is done.
Yes, absolutely.
You hire a new salesperson, and you get them. I mean, it is.
They're going to marinate in training.
They're going to marinate in training. You hire a new marketing person. How do they get trained again?
They probably say, watch the vendor's website, the videos on the vendor's website of how to operate this technology.
That's exactly right. Now, and I understand, because for a long time, sales was the only part of the organization that impacted revenue. But marketing is impacting revenue now. So why shouldn't they, like there is a sales enablement structure, why shouldn't there be a marketing enablement structure?
Yes, that was very interesting in the book as well. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, marketing enablement is just that. If I have an organization that is helping me drive revenue and growth, like sales is, mm-hmm. and I'm investing in their training because I want to optimize every interaction that they have during that sales cycle, well, marketing is selling as well. They're selling in a different way. They're creating these digital relationships. They're mining for digital actions that then becomes digital insights, right? Where's the training for these people? There's no framework, right? Mm-hmm. There is no, it's just like, here's your piece, and here's your little piece, and here's your little piece, and here's your little piece. And that would never happen within a sales organization. There are a few organizations that I've run across. I believe it was Red Hat had a marketing enablement structure in place. But I'm a big believer in training. This latest generation of workers that we have, they all expect more training. And you have to do it within a framework that helps drive the business. And that is what is missing in marketing.
Yes. And they should all be listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Absolutely.
Every Friday in the conference room, you know, bring your lunches. So, Debbie, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
You have to be customer focused moving into 2023. You have to, it's not about the technology. It's about how you can use that technology to create these optimal customer experiences that allow you to know the customer better, from which you can mine insights that are actionable and that you can share across your organization.
Mm. Well said, and as easy and as it is to say, be more focused on the customer, it seems like the most difficult thing for organizations.
It is. The good news about marketing is they do have a passion for the customer. It's just that the rest of the organization sometimes gets in the way, especially the more product-centric that they are. They just have to start thinking outside the box. And again, Douglas, it all stems eventually from leadership.
Yes. And in also in the book, you talk about how the successful marketers are advocating for the customer. Sometimes it's almost as if they're the only ones at the table saying, has anyone thought about the customer? Like the way Jeff Bezos always wants an empty chair at every conference room table.
Sad, but true.
Yeah.
And
he wants that empty chair to remind everybody of the customer.
Yeah, they turn to the empty chair and say, what would the customer say? What would the customer think about this? That is a very difficult cultural barrier for a lot of organizations. Mm-hmm. And when marketing wants to be passionate about the customer, there's only so many things they can do, so far that they can push it, and yet they can still be successful. But they just have more that they have more barriers that they have to work with.
Yes, yes. So is there one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book, just to get them thinking about it until the book shows up?
Let's see. What could they do today? What is the one thing that they could put into action? I would kind of like take a look at 2023 and say, what is the business that marketing is responsible for? What should we be doing that we are not doing? And take a look at what other organizations are doing. Really be honest about your gaps. It's kind of like doing a self-assessment in how you can improve going into 2023. And look for opportunities to do things differently, like versus taking a look at that funnel. Go take a look at your customer journey and say, we're not doing anything on that part of the customer journey. And could we be successful working on that part of the customer journey? Mm. So I think it's a good time of the year to take a look at where you are, where you want to be, and some things that you can do differently.
Great advice. And think like a revenue marketer.
love that one.
Yeah.
Like a revenue marketer.
Well, there was a book on the show that I talk about all the time called The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader, and by Barta and Barwise. And they took all this data and they looked at the perceptions of marketers, and it's not good, but the really successful marketers are the ones that follow their advice from the book, which is get in the revenue camp. It's almost like they wrote their book as a companion to yours. They keep saying over and over, get in the revenue camp. And it's just such a great thing for marketers to think about, particularly all those marketers that haven't been told you're responsible for revenue. Just start asking about it. Start trying to figure that out. I think you'll be perceived differently, and you will become you'll be on your way to that seat at the table.
Absolutely, I agree. And I want to go read that book now. I haven't read that one yet.
Oh, you're going to love it. It's like they're channeling you.
I do believe that Barwise might be one of the people that I quoted in my dissertation. I'm not sure, but I did have...
He's at London Business School.
Could be.
PhD.
Could be.
Yeah.
Right, so now I have to go. I have to make sure I go get that book next.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, you'll like it. You'll like it. Barta had worked at McKinsey, and they had a lot of data about marketers and the perception of marketers. And so as you read the book, it's going to be a big affirmation for you, but it talks about the perception and then also what the most successful marketers are doing now. And a lot of it has to do with the word you've been talking about quite a bit, leadership. So, well, are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Yes, The Jolt. Our CMO here recently read it, and she
Debbie?
Heard about the book. Yes, Debbie.
Uh-huh.
Swanky. She heard about it from your podcast, and she read it. She said, Debbie, you have to read this book. She said, it will give you shivers. It is so good. So The Jolt is the next book. And then I definitely want to read The 12 Powers of a Marketing Leader.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, The Jolt Effect. One of the authors is Matt Dixon, who was one of the co-authors of The Challenger Sale, Challenger Customer.
Oh, got it. And I know I'm going to love it now.
Yeah,
okay.
It's really, really good. You're going to like it. So, well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, your company's site, your personal site, your LinkedIn profile, and so forth. And now a word to you, dear listener, please do me a big favor. Reach out to Debbie and congratulate her on the book and thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send her a message on LinkedIn or on our website in some way. Guests on the show have told me how much they enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so, well, ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, page 265. In the foreword of this book, Scott Brinker wrote, "Let's face it, marketing operations has been the island of misfit toys." His words are true. The less than flattering perception combined with the unleashed potential of marketing operations inspired me to write this book. I wanted a book that provided frustrated marketers with inspiration, a vision for what can be, the value of a new approach, and a practical path forward to becoming a strategic marketing operations organization. I wanted a book that highlighted the role of strategic marketing operations as a game changer. I wanted a book that provided guidance on how to move from the back room to the boardroom. As a forward-thinking and acting marketing leader, it is now up to you to take the ideas, models, charts, stories, and best practices presented in this book and use them to plot your journey. You can use this to help accelerate your current journey or to begin your journey for the first time. Now you have the framework, and it's time to put strategy into action. Is it hard? Yes. Does it happen overnight? No. Is it worth it? Absolutely. The book is From Backroom to Boardroom, Earn Your Seat with Strategic Marketing Operations. The author is Debbie Gagish. Debbie, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, thank you for having me. And anyone who wants to reach out to me, my job is to talk to the market. I would love to have a conversation with you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a free copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you're one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."